David Crow. Thank you for tuning in to episode 47 of The Infectious Myth. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions for future guests, you can email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com, or you can like us and participate in discussions at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth, or follow us on Twitter at infectiousmyth. We're on iTunes and other podcast programs. Remember, I don't know you're listening till I hear from you. If you do send in a comment and include your mailing address, letting me know how you're staying in touch with the show and what your thoughts are about it, I will send you a small gift. In episode 44, I talked to Lisa Bloomquist, who was injured by fluoroquinolone antibiotics, and through self-education and talking to others in a similar situation, started back on the road to health. Today we have another remarkable story about devastating illness and a recovery through what some might see as unconventional means. Our guest is going to be Dr. Terry Walls. She is an MD who was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis in 2000. Her back and stomach muscles had weakened so much that within 3 years she needed a tilt-recline wheelchair in order to get around. It looked like she was headed for a miserable remainder to a short life. But she still had her full intellect and medical knowledge and used that to research autoimmune disease and brain biology and decided she was going to heal herself with food, not pharmaceuticals, and not pills or supplements. She adopted the paleo diet and slowly regained her strength to the point where she could ride 18 miles on a bicycle in one day. In 2011, she gave a TED talk that was extremely popular, and in 2014, she published a book co-authored with Eve Adamson titled The Walls Protocol. We will put a link to her website, terrywalls.com, in the show notes, and through that you can get more information about her book and other of her ideas. Welcome to the show, Dr. Walls.
Hey, thank you for having me.
And can I call you Terry from now on?
Oh, sure, that'd be fine.
Okay. So what were the first times that you were getting multiple sclerosis, and when was this?
So, you know, in retrospect, my fifth symptoms were probably episodes of face pain that I had during medical school, and I was more likely to have trouble when I had a particularly stressful rotation, up late, not sleeping much, and a lot of tension on the team because things were so stressful. Then I had an episode of visual dimming, I think about 5 years later, that about my docs couldn't figure out what that was. And then,
and by visual dimming, you mean that like the world seemed to get darker around you?
Yes. Yeah. You know, actually, I was out rollerblading on a August day training for a ski race.
Right.
I had skied about 5 miles, and then realized that my left eye, all I could see was light and shadows. It was very, very black.
Oh, okay.
And dark. But that resolved by the time I walked back to my house. I got home. My vision was normal. And the workup couldn't reveal any explanation. But every time I skied too hard, trained too hard, or tried taking a sauna, I became essentially blind in my left eye.
Oh, so it kept going. And then you started to get more full body manifestations. Like, what kinds of symptoms?
So the next things that happened was I continued to have more episodes of face pain. These are sort of like trigeminal neuralgia. That's a sharp jolt of electrical-type pain at the temple that would spread across my scalp and the left, you know, and one side of my face. They would come on randomly. It was more likely to happen if I had been severely stressed by something.
Right.
And then they would gradually fade over the next couple of weeks. The frequency and the severity and the intensity of the pain would gradually increase. But it was in 2000 when I noticed that my left leg was weak. If I couldn't walk for 2 or 3 miles, then my leg became very weak. And that's when I went in, saw my family physician, who then sent me to a neurology doctor to try and sort out what was going on.
Mm-hmm. And you were diagnosed with multiple sclerosis at that point?
Correct. You know, and I knew at that point that one third of all who were diagnosed with MS will develop problems walking, needing a cane, walker, or wheelchair.
Right.
And that one half would be unable to work within 10 years because of severe fatigue. And at that point, my children were age 5 and 8, and I was the main breadwinner for our family.
Right.
So I looked around for the best MS center who was doing research that I could find, and that was the Cleveland Clinic.
Mm-hmm.
So I went there for a second opinion. They looked everything over and said, yes, you have MS. And then I started taking the newest drugs and was seen by their best people.
Right, and what kind of therapy did they recommend?
Well, you know, we talked about the ABCR drugs, Avonex, Betaseron, Copaxone, Rebif. And I ended up on Copaxone, still within 3 years. I'd had only one episode of a relapse.
Right.
So one transient episode of right arm weakness. That would have been considered a huge success.
Right.
Because they count the number of relapses and only had one in 3 years, so that would be a success. But the problem was I was getting steadily weaker. It was harder to stand, harder to walk, harder to sit up in a regular chair. And so by the fall of 2003, I'm in a tilt-reclined wheelchair.
And were you in it?
Fatigue is a big deal.
Were you in the wheelchair all the time or some of the time?
So I certainly used it to get around anywhere. We got a special zero-gravity chair in my office so I could recline way back, have my knees higher than my nose.
Right.
And if I left my office, I was in that reclined wheelchair.
Wow. And so you weren't really happy with the way things were going, even if the doctors thought that it was somewhat contained. You didn't think so.
Yeah, it was contained, but you know, it looked to me like conventional medicine was not going to stop my slide into a bedridden and quite possibly demented life.
Right. Were there any neurological effects in the sense of, like, did your mind feel clear, or were you starting to...
Well, you know, I would say I felt very clear this summer of 2007. I could tell that I was beginning to have some trouble. I was losing my keys. I had lost my phone several times. I lost my keys, and those expensive ones with the electronic...
Right.
That, you know, it was $150-$200 every time I was losing my keys. That was very painful.
Right, right.
And I was having to keep a little notebook with me all the time, you know, what I need to do, what next, etc.
Right. I mean, when did you decide that you hit bottom and needed to do something different?
So, you know, when I was first diagnosed, I started reading the literature, and I was just getting more and more upset by what I was reading, and I agreed with my family to stop reading the science and just let find the best people and let them take care of me.
Right.
In 2002, my neurology docs at the Cleveland Clinic mentioned the work by Lauren Cordain, so I read his book, read all of his scientific papers, and decided after 20 years of being a vegetarian to go back to eating meat. That was a pretty big deal for me,
right.
But I continued to decline. When I hit the wheelchair in 2003, actually that's when I started reading the science again, because I figured, okay, I know how bad this is going to get.
Right.
I know I'll probably become bedridden, but let me read, see if I can slow this down. And so I started reading mouse models of MS, Parkinson's, Huntington's, mm-hmm. Lou Gehrig's. And I decided that mitochondria were key, and I slowly started developing a vitamin supplement cocktail.
Okay.
That certainly slowed my decline, and I could tell if I missed my vitamins and supplements, I was much more exhausted the next day.
Well, it's interesting you bring up mitochondria, because in a recent episode talking about people who've had problems with fluoroquinolone antibiotics, mitochondria are believed to be one of the targets. And for
yes.
the listeners who might not know, I mean, I mentioned this on that show as well, but the mitochondria manage the energy inside the cell. So if you lose function in your mitochondria, and anything requires energy is degraded, especially muscular parts of your body.
Absolutely. Your brain, your heart, your muscles.
I mean, everything relies on mitochondria,
yeah.
I think. So that is a big thing. So you figured the mitochondria were involved.
Well, really important.
Yeah.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
You know, so I started taking vitamins and supplements to help the mitochondria.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, after a few months of that, I thought I was wasting my money, so I quit everything. And that turned out I couldn't get out of bed. I was just completely exhausted the next couple of days, went back on my supplements, and then popped up and went to work. And, you know, that was an incredibly exciting moment for me. I felt like, wow. And so I repeated the experiment again a couple of weeks later with the same results. And now,
so stopping your supplements and vitamins and then
regimen.
And sort of crashing.
And crashing. And so now I am very excited because I've reached the conclusion that I can find out things based on my reading that my doctors don't know to tell me.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So now I'm spending a little more time working on reading. And, you know, so over time, I slowly add a few more vitamins and supplements. I'm still declining, although
right.
It's slow. By the summer of 2007, I can't sit in a regular chair more than 10 minutes. I'm either fully reclined or in bed, and I'm beginning to have brain fog. That summer, I discovered the functional medicine group, and I took their
mm-hmm.
course on neuroprotection.
Yeah.
In the midst of my brain fog, so I did go through it many times to get it down. I now had a much longer list of vitamins and supplements.
Right.
And a deeper understanding of what some of the issues were. But then, I'll say, I may have improved just a bit. But at the end of the year, when I made this leap that I should take this long list of vitamins and supplements and figure out where they were in the food supply.
Right.
And so now
right.
I reorganized my diet, still following the paleo diet principles, but now I organized it to include all the nutrients that functional medicine said I should have.
Mm-hmm.
And that I knew I should have based on the research I'd been doing. So actually, we now track 36 nutrients in that process.
Wow.
But that's when the magic happened. Yeah,
right.
A month later, after I'd reorganized my diet, my fatigue is gone, my brain fog is gone. At 3 months, I'm walking around the hospital without a cane.
Wow.
At 6 months, I even walk over to the university hospital without a cane. And then at 12 months, I'm able to do a 20-mile bike ride with my family.
Wow.
I admit, I did take a couple rests. Along the way.
I think most people that ride 20 miles on a bike take a couple of rests.
They get to have a stop and have an apple here and there.
Yes, that's true.
But that was when I realized, okay, I'm breaking all the rules here. Who knows what might be possible?
I mean, you're starting to go up now after years of...
You know, what's remarkable is that I had recovered remarkably, but I had so accepted that there's only one way you go with MS, that's downhill.
Right.
I can only see that, okay, I've stopped the decline. And, you know, I'm walking around the block.
Right.
And I don't really know what the future might bring. And I'd gotten so used to you just take things one day at a time.
Right.
And had accepted the fact that I'd become profoundly disabled. So it was that Mother's Day when I rode my bike around the block for the first time. You know, I sat down with my family. I'm like, you know, I don't think anybody knows what's going to happen here. We don't know how much recovery I might have, but maybe full recovery is possible.
I mean, had your family kind of accepted that you were going to slip away from them, that they were going to lose you?
Oh, yeah.
You?
I mean, you know, we all went through a period of being angry, bargaining, denial,
yes.
And
mm-hmm.
we all finally got to that. This is the way life is, and had come to accept it.
Yes. I've got two questions. Were you still on the pharmaceutical drugs at this point, or had you stopped those?
So I had taken the ABCR drugs. I took Novantrone. Then I took Tysabri, which is a very potent biologic. Then I was placed on Celcept. When my fatigue went away, we stopped Provigil. I called my... neurologist went in to chat with him and told him I wanted to go off the Celcept because I was doing so well. He agreed, and we tapered that medication and stopped it.
Right.
So I've not been on any disease-modifying drugs since early March 2008.
Okay. And you said you modified the paleo diet. So when did you start the paleo diet? And can you describe for our listeners
sure.
approximately what that is?
I started the paleo diet in 2002, which meant I took away all grain, all legumes, all dairy. I ate vegetables and meat.
Right.
And when I restructured my paleo diet, I structured it specifically to be sure that I was getting more sulfur, more minerals. I wanted a little more iodine. And so I had these lots of lists of these foods that would stress these 36 nutrients that I was looking for. But then as I started teaching this diet to the rest of the world, I realized I couldn't just give people food lists. So we created food rolls that get the things that we want. And so I have the 3 cups of greens, 3 cups of sulfur-rich vegetables in the cabbage, onion, or mushroom family, and 3 cups of things that are deeply colored like carrots, beets, or berries.
Right.
6 to 12 ounces of meat. I like to see people having organ meat several times a week and include seaweed in their diet as well. And then we may get a bit more structured and more advanced after that. But that basic diet that I just described is what got me out of my wheelchair.
And so what are, can you give some examples of some of the foods that you specifically added to your paleo diet that you think really helped you or were filling in gaps?
Well, you know, I thought I ate a lot of vegetables, but when you go up to 9 cups,
right,
now you're eating lots of vegetables and just some meat.
Right.
So I think just pushing up all the vegetables probably pushed up the fiber intake a whole lot, shifted my microbiome, added many, many more antioxidants, which,
right,
you know, in a lot of these phytonutrients that speak to our DNA, you know, flipping genes on and off, probably in a much more favorable way.
Right.
And then the other thing, you know, other things I did that were really important is that, you know, I improved the quality of my food by going organic and then really working on my detoxification pathways.
Right.
So
and,
I could,
and did you say grain was included?
Green as in leafy green.
Green, okay. I thought you said grain. I was surprised by that.
Yes.
So
yeah.
Leafy greens.
Leafy greens. You know, things like dandelion, kale,
right,
collards, beet greens.
Okay.
And
then in terms of color.
Learned how to make this stuff so that my 2 children were still at home in high school.
Right.
In junior high, would eat it. And actually, we did manage to find ways of making food that was met all of their standards as well.
Yes, well, that's not necessarily easy with teenagers,
no,
but I think if anybody in America has the worst possible diet, it's got to be teenagers. That sort of
yes, absolutely.
Low point.
Absolutely.
I remember talking to a high-powered pediatrician, and he said, oh, nobody in America is malnourished. And I said, well, what about a teenager who lives on, like, hamburgers?
Sugar and white flour.
Yeah, sugar and white flour. And he said, well, maybe in that case. And I said, well, that's like half the teenagers in North America. So that's a lot of people.
We are so malnourished as a country.
Yes.
If you look at our mineral status, we're not getting in, our minerals, we're not getting our vitamins, antioxidants. 150 pounds of sugar, 130 pounds of white flour per person per year.
Yes.
Equals malnourishment in my eyes.
And do you think, like, this business of the food groups is responsible? It kind of dumbs down the concept of food?
No, what I think is really responsible is that biologically we are all vulnerable to becoming addicted to sugar and white flour.
Mm.
And unfortunately, we didn't realize that. So over time, society's got that addiction has gotten to be deeper and deeper. It has probably very little to do with government policy and everything to do with our vulnerability to addiction and the fact the food companies are able to manipulate their product to increase consumption by making foods hyper-palatable and
right,
giving a stronger stimulus to the dopamine secreting areas of the brain.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I observed about food a long time ago was that sort of the Western diet is very amenable to making food that looks good. Like from a structural point of view, flour and sugar are very easy to make into just about any shape or color that you want. And so you can make food that's superficially extremely attractive, and you know, it's basically just a sugar bomb when you eat it.
Yeah. And because that sugar bomb stimulates our dopamine, you know, we will keep going back.
Right.
And when I give this talk, people, they all want to know what is the replacement for sweet. And you know, I had this conversation, you know, that's your point of addiction. Get I encourage people to just get, deal with their addiction, have their withdrawal, and then when you're on the other side, you discover that food tastes very differently.
Yeah, I agree with you that that sugar is an addiction, and you can work your way out of it. You can eat. It's hard to go cold turkey, but you can reduce it, and then you reduce your taste for sugar,
yeah.
So you don't need as much. But it takes a long time.
It takes commitment. It takes really understanding why it's worth going through that discomfort.
Yes, I remember. I actually, when I was in university in the 70s, I wrote a paper on sugar. I was taking a course on economic plants or something, and I remember that the British, I had statistics, the British were eating 125 pounds of sugar at that point, and it sounds like things are about the same or worse now, and just how toxic part of our diet this was, and how we can easily reach for this quick hit of calories. Were you using aspartame when
No.
you were sick? You never used aspartame?
No, I was not.
Okay.
You know, I may have had some, but I was certainly not a heavy
right.
Soda drinker or aspartame drinker by any means.
Because I know a lot of people try to get their sugar fix by changing to aspartame, and that's...
Yeah, and now stevia. I get lots of questions about stevia and Splenda.
Yes. I mean, do you personally feel that what you're eating is more palatable than what you used to eat, or
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
The food is delicious. You know, last night we made lamb stew. We had cooked beet greens, a big mixed salad, and then a chia pudding for dessert. And my daughter, who's 20, was like, oh, my God, Mom, this is just the best.
That's amazing. Yes.
So, you know, if I can make food that my teenage kids and now young adult kids are coming around saying, like, oh, my God, this is, you know, they really like the taste of it.
Yes, because it is, I mean, I think when people have teenagers and teenagers are grumpy and they're trying to keep them happy, so they kind of go to the lowest common denominator of food, and yet...
It takes an ongoing conversation all the time with their kids to combat all that marketing pressure and to have them understand the link between food and performance.
Yes. I mean, did you see a change in the health of your children?
Of my kids? So my son has asthma and acne. When I convinced him to go gluten-free,
right.
His asthma and acne completely cleared up.
Yes.
My daughter has asthma, a little bit of acne, and some anxiety issues. Again, cleared up
right.
With the diet. Her academic performance increased. Her frequent migraines, which had caused her to miss a lot of school the year before, also resolved.
Right.
She's now a art history and studio art major at the University of Iowa. Spent 3 months in India.
Okay.
And couldn't stay gluten-free there. So she... had 3 weeks of headache and worsening asthma, so
right.
She was texting me about how uncomfortable she was, and commenting that she really should have planned how to deal with food much more better than she did. So yeah, she got back. She's back on a regular diet. Her asthma's cleared up.
Yeah.
Her headaches are gone, and
right.
She's talking more about how she has to pay more attention to this when she's traveling.
Yes. Do you include many fermented foods in your diet?
You know, I do. I like making, I think making fermented foods is very fun. We've made kombucha for many years. I've made beet kvass also, which is very fun.
Mm-hmm.
And then I do lacto-fermented vegetables of all types. I haven't gotten into doing the fruit chutneys yet, but I'm thinking that would be a very fun thing to try next summer.
Yes, I want to figure out how to make kimchi, because I love kimchi, and I know it's really healthy. It's basically sauerkraut with hot pepper.
Sauerkraut with hot pepper, ginger, and garlic.
Yeah.
You can moderate it just a little bit by putting in a green apple or a green pear.
To moderate it by make it a little less...
A little less zingy if you're...
if you don't want that. I probably want it more zingy. So
yes. So we have the mild version for my wife, and the hot version for my daughter and myself, because we like things with we say a lot of kick.
Yes. Yes. I kind of got addicted to kimchi in a couple of trips to Korea. Do you have any carbohydrates in your current diet?
So, yes, not many. Most of my carbohydrates are coming from the non-starchy vegetables. You know, I might have a half cup of berries. I'll have the resistant starch, as in the chia seeds, ground flax seeds. And I will allow myself to have occasionally raw carrots, raw beets. That's very nice in the salad. The sweet potatoes, I particularly like the dark purple ones we've found.
Mm-hmm.
So I will occasionally have, again, a very small amount of those. But I like to be either in ketosis or next to ketosis.
Ketosis
so
being?
I'm not having many carbs.
Oh, okay, okay. And have there been times where you've felt some kind of regression and you've had to...
Oh, yeah. You know, staying... So gluten, dairy, protein, eggs are... I rev up the inflammation in my body and my brain, and then I will have a flare of my face pain, either on my right face or my left face.
Right.
And while I understand how meticulous you have to be, you know, I think my friends and the restaurants don't really necessarily understand how, when I say I need gluten, dairy, egg-free, it really needs to be that way. So 4 years ago, I got some gluten served to me, and then the waiter came out and said, oops, that soup did have gluten in it. So 48 hours later, I had face pain and hand weakness. And then there was another time, again, that I got this through a restaurant, and I had they served it to me, and then the restaurant said, oops, we didn't really mean to do that.
Right.
And 48 hours later, I have get into trouble.
Right. So, if you cut down a lot on eating in restaurants, it must...
Well, I've now modified my approach, and I... So, here's the line that I use. Sir or madam, I have a severe reaction that's actually life-threatening to gluten, dairy, and eggs. I need to know, is it safe to eat here, and what would you recommend on your menu? So... usually that gets their attention. They're like, let me go back and talk to the chef. I'll be right back.
Yeah, I mean, they probably have lots of people who say, I'm allergic to this, and then they eat it anyway.
Correct.
And so they get desensitized to how serious...
they get desensitized to how serious it is.
For some people, yes.
And, you know, I say it's a life-threatening reaction. It's sort of like the reaction that people have, you know, IgE, and that's life-threatening within minutes. Mine is life-threatening at 48 hours.
Right.
So anyway, now that I say I have a life-threatening reaction to these three foods, what do you recommend? They take it much more seriously. They usually go back, talk to the chef, then they come back and say, okay, here are the things that we suggest. And I'm flexible enough, I will always order one of those things then. Like, okay.
Yes.
Yeah, that's fine. And now that works out. The other thing that I've done, I mean, it just has to be very careful, both with personal care products, read through all the vitamin supplement label things that you're taking, be sure that's labeled gluten-free, dairy-free.
What do you mean by personal care products, like soaps and...
Soaps, lipsticks or makeup. Makeup is very toxic in general, and a lot of it has gluten in it as an adhesive.
Oh, really?
So you have to be careful to have gluten-free makeup.
Oh, and are there other things in makeup that you look for? I mean, I know there's a lot of toxic things in a lot of makeup.
Well, you know, actually, what I end up doing now is I let people know that I'm looking for organic, gluten-free. And then because of all the media stuff I'm doing now, I have to also say, by the way, it's got to deal with highlights because of media presentations. And then I have my friends help out because I'm not into makeup, so I don't really understand any of this. And so I consult with some friends as these issues arise.
Oh, okay. When did you decide to write a book? I guess you're getting a lot of people asking you for advice.
Oh, sure. You know, when I first began to get better, I called our local co-op and said, pitched the idea of doing a talk, which was extraordinarily successful. Then I wrote a just a very short, simple little book, a few recipes, and had 500 copies printed that I'd take to these lectures. And I was out of those in about 2 months.
Right.
I was like, wow, man, I guess. Then I self-published a longer version of the book, and did that in early 2010. And then I had that TEDx talk that went viral, had now over 2 million views. And so then that led to that self-published book, you know, selling many, many, many thousands of books.
Right.
And my publisher, you know, actually my co-writer, also lives here in Iowa City, had discovered my work and adopted the protocol, changed her life and her son's life. And I remember when I was waiting to pick up my vegetables from the community-sponsored agriculture drop-off point, and Eve said, "Hi, I'm Eve Adamson. I write health and wellness books, and you know, with experts. And I think you've got a New York Times bestseller in you, and I would really like to be the one to help you write it."
Well, that brings up an interesting point, because your TEDx video, when I went to look at it, it has a little note on it that says, "This talk, which was filmed in an independent TEDx event, falls outside TEDx's curatorial guidelines." Can you explain that note?
You know, I can only think they must be either self-censoring themselves or getting pressure from pharmaceuticals, because the controversy in my talk is I tell my personal story of how I used science to guide the development of this food and dietary approach that reversed my MS. And then I said, and by the way, I'm studying this in others, and we're going to be presenting our data at the neuroscience convention the following week. And TED periodically says, you know, this is not real. And so we send them our manuscripts that have been published, peer-reviewed articles, our abstracts where we've presented peer-reviewed at national and international meetings. So we beat off the taking it down, but we couldn't beat off the falls outside curatorial guidelines. And they did that when it's about 1.5 million views.
Right.
So it's continued to stay viral.
Right.
We now have a copy of it, so if they take it down, we'll just put it back up.
Right, right.
And then we'll put it back up on a site that they can.
Yes, I just thought that was remarkable how these organizations bend over backwards to keep the medical establishment happy. But that brings me to another point, because you are part of the medical establishment. You're still practicing as an MD.
As an MD, I'm still a professor of medicine. And I think it's very important. I love doing research. I think it's very important to do some research to understand the mechanisms of why these things work, what are all the diseases they work in, and why. And so I'm the person here at the university who's doing intensive nutritional studies. You know, and I've gone quite rapidly from when people, you know, heard what I was doing in 2009, thought maybe this was a bit odd, to now being visionary, going around to various departments of the university showing these amazing videos I have of people walking before and after, and, you know, the dramatic changes we're able to cause.
Right.
And I fortunately froze a lot of blood all along the way, so now I'm entertaining proposals from our basic scientists. What are the things that we should go look at to measure in terms of what all has changed?
I presume you're not applying to the pharmaceutical companies for funding.
No, that was not in the plan.
Yes. Now, how has your knowledge changed how you practice medicine? And can you give some examples of how you would do things differently now?
In 2008, when I first started practicing in the traumatic brain injury clinic, I started talking to the vets a lot about food quality, B vitamins, fish oil. And in my primary care, I talk a lot about diet quality. The VA was so impressed with the results that I was getting, both in primary care and the traumatic brain injury clinic, they approached me about creating a functional medicine clinic that I could run that would be focused entirely on diet and lifestyle. So we have that. We've had that up and running for a year and a half now, we keep reinventing how we do this, so we could let as many people come through as are interested. And now I'm running group classes, teaching people these concepts. We have great success. We've seen people with rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue, diabetes, obesity, bipolar, Parkinson's, psoriasis, chronic pain, all have dramatic reductions in pain, improvements in mood, improvement in quality of life, reduction in needed medications. We have just completed the IRB application so we could have a chart review of everyone who's gone through and to write up a case series on what we're seeing.
Okay, IRB being the Institutional Review Board, which
correct.
You have to get ethical approval of.
Make sure that we're conducting science properly.
Right, right.
Oh, you know what? Another thing that's very exciting, the Veteran Affairs main office there in Washington, D.C., has gotten interested in, is anyone doing functional medicine in the field? And
right.
So then they ultimately heard about us, and they're like, oh, my gosh. So now there's group calls, and it looks like there's more international interest in functional medicine and using dietary and lifestyle approach as well.
And how do you define functional medicine?
Well, I use this, learned about it through the Institute for Functional Medicine, where we're trying to understand what are the person's antecedents, that is all the risk factors, genetically and environmentally, and how this impacts how some of the basic physiologies of their bodies work,
mm-hmm.
how diet and lifestyle behaviors, how healthy those are. And then we design a program to address as many of the factors as we can under the person's control. And usually there's going to be a heavy emphasis on diet,
right.
perhaps some targeted vitamins and supplements, and the beginning of some lifestyle changes to address stress and movement.
So what are some of the lifestyle changes that you feel
so
are necessary?
So I routinely talk about how if we don't get our cortisol levels, that is our stress hormones, back to normal for large parts of the day, our cell chemistry is all shifted towards fight or flight and can't do any of the repair and maintenance work. And that seems to help people understand that, okay, we do have to stop, sit down, and take even just 1 or 2 minutes twice a day doing a meditative or a stress-reducing practice. Then we talk about movement.
Mm-hmm.
I meet people where they're at and have a conversation whether it's easier for them to do everything all at once, this is a new way you live, or if it's easier to have, here's what you do the first week, here's what you do the second week, and here's what you do the third week.
Right.
And, you know, a lot of my folks are ready to make a huge drag change all at once.
Right.
And others are going to do this incrementally. And we meet the vets where they're at.
I mean, eventually you're going to get there if you have if once a week you make a change.
A big change.
You're going
now,
to get to
in my lifestyle clinic, people at the very least have to go gluten-free.
Mm-hmm.
If they can't do that, we fire them, and I send them to meet with the dietitian individually.
Right.
But if they're going to be part of the group class, they have to be understand they've committed to being gluten-free at the very least.
And, I mean, are you... there's a lot of people who eat gluten and stay healthy.
Oh, yeah. Well, and we talk about that. I explain that not everybody has a gluten sensitivity problem.
Mm-hmm.
In that if you are healthy, great mental health, ideal body weight, then the programs that you're doing are serving you well, and by all means you can stay on that.
Right. So this is not for everybody, but there are so many people in North America who are chronically ill.
Chronically ill, they're overweight.
Yes.
Or obese, that's 70% of us.
Right. I mean, you were not overweight. I mean, you were a pretty A-type active person.
Yeah.
But maybe you were...
Well, although, you know, I will say, when I adopted this diet, my weight, and this is true of everyone that was put on it, their weight comes down back to a healthier body weight for them, typically what they were weighing in their early 20s.
Interesting. What about exercise? Do you recommend things there?
Well, I like to see people move again, and I talk about the benefits of strength training and the benefits of balance training. Yoga, Tai Chi, Pilates are great. If you'd rather go to the gym and work out, that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
If you simply want to wear a step counter and increase your physical activity by changing your habits during the day, that's also a possibility.
Right.
So we raise it as something that's important to then use motivational interviewing to figure out what approach will work for that person.
And do you think that self-discipline is like the biggest reason for failure? Like people just can't?
Oh, no, I think it's failure to treat this like an addiction.
Hmm.
So if you understand and accept that you have an addiction to foods that are harmful,
right,
then it's easier for people to understand when we say you must control your environment. You have to have somebody go through the house, remove it all for you.
Right.
And you must have, when you're eating food, everyone in your household agree that they're only going to eat steady compliant stuff in your presence.
Oh, okay.
Later in your life, you might be able to be around the contraband.
Right.
But certainly not early.
Right. So you, I guess family support, or support of friends and family is
very
pretty
important. We need to have people agree that you're going to that treat this an addiction. And so we would always, you know, I explained it. If you had a crack addiction, I would not expect you to live in a crack house while you yourself stopped doing crack and everyone else was doing it around you and left all the paraphernalia for you.
Yeah, I mean, maybe a more common example is somebody who's an alcoholic and you have them over for supper. It's like nobody should be drinking alcohol unless you know that that person's far enough along that they can handle that. Because just being around alcohol can trigger things.
That's right. So the people who understand we're dealing with addiction and their family's willing to support them, they'll be successful.
Yes.
Those who think, well, I can do this and my family's going to do whatever they want, they will probably fail.
Yes.
It's much harder.
What are the major components of your book? Like, what will people find?
We have the first, it's in three parts. The first part talks about functional medicine, conventional medicine, and how they're different. It also gives them an overview of my personal story. The mm-hmm. second part, part two, talks about food and explains how our diet has changed from over time. Hunter-gatherers to farmers to the industrialized society and now mm-hmm. post-World War II society. And then it talks about the first level diet, we call the Walls diet, which is a bit easier, and many, many people find that's all they really need to do. Then we talk about the second level diet, which is the Walls paleo diet, where we add a few more new foods. And then the third level, which is the ketogenic version of my diet. I talk about why you might want to go into ketosis and what some of the interesting research questions that are being examined right now.
Yeah, maybe you can explain that a little bit more because I don't really know what ketosis is.
So ketosis means that your mitochondria, instead of burning sugar, are burning fat.
Mm-hmm.
And they do that based on the ketone bodies that your liver makes. It turns out that our brains do very well on ketones and fat,
mm-hmm.
But we generally make the transition from sugar burning to fat burning gradually over
right.
a couple of days. It looks like it's a terrific treatment for brain cancer,
okay.
seizures, early dementia loss, and it's being studied in MS, schizophrenia, And many, many types of cancer.
I mean, wasn't this considered to be kind of a type of starvation, when your body is burned through
it
all
this? It absolutely was. You know, yeah. When it was first studied, it was called the water diet, and it was pretty close to starvation. But at that time, there were no treatments for seizure control. Right. And they discovered that putting people on these water diets stopped the seizures.
But then you'd starve to death. So in this case...
So that didn't work out. And gradually figured out you could add more fat, just a little bit of protein and a little bit of carbs.
Right.
And so it's a very tough diet to have publicly.
Right.
I've created a modification of that based on medium-chain triglycerides in coconut milk, coconut oil. That lets you have more carbs, and I think it's still nutrient dense.
Yes.
But lets you be in ketosis.
That's quite amazing. And so you're saying that this is for the people who have the most serious problems, like most people don't need to go this far.
That have more serious problems or have cancer. I certainly admit that the research is very early on, so I can't say definitively which of the three diets is the best.
Right.
We can talk about what I've observed personally, it's sort of fun to watch what the, my public community is saying about what they're doing and observing.
Yeah. So what kinds of changes have you seen in people who have gone on this ketosis creating diet?
So we've had several folks who've lost 100 to 200 pounds without being hungry. It had no longer taken any medications for diabetes, high blood pressure, lipid disorders, and feel the best they've felt in decades.
Right.
We've had people who had been so disabled by Parkinson's that all they could do was lay on the couch and tremor, who were back up walking around, enjoying their family, taking their dogs for hikes. Fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue, Lyme's. Many people with Lyme's disease who've been taking... their antibiotic regimen with their infectious disease specialist for several years, report that it was when they discovered my protocol and really addressed diet and lifestyle that they recovered.
Interesting.
And then we have all sorts of autoimmune conditions. And I'll tell you, there are many that I've not even heard of, that people are telling me that they have these conditions, adopted my protocol, and have found it to be profoundly helpful.
Have some of your colleagues found this information interesting, and have some others been hostile? Like, what has been the reaction amongst your medical colleagues?
Well, when I first started talking to the public about this back in 2009, many of my physician colleagues criticized me and said, one case, so what?
Yes.
And then, with the help of some senior scientists and support from my chief of medicine, we wrote a grant, got funding, and started a research protocol testing this, my protocol, and others with progressive MS. And what we, every year we would show our data, and people would come by, and they were very impressed because our data is so compelling.
Yes.
And now that we have papers out, in peer-reviewed publications, and I have these amazing videos, now I've gone from being like strange, maybe I should not be part of the College of Medicine, to being one of the university's extraordinary, visionary, groundbreaking researchers.
Yes.
And that all happened in just, 7 years.
And do you think that being in a somewhat smaller city helped? Like, if you had been in New York City, do you think you would have got away with this? Would there be more pressure on you to shut up?
Well, I think what it really helped was my colleagues saw me come walking around. And they knew I'd been a big time athlete because I did medical school here and was a black belt and doing all that stuff.
Right.
So they saw me hit the wheelchair, spend 4 years in a wheelchair, and then recover, start walking, biking, hiking, biking to and from work.
Okay.
And so the chair of medicine, the chief of medicine at the VA, the chair of medicine at both institutions, and the dean had watched this.
Right.
And they had called me and said, this is really important, Terry. You write up, get a case report written. And then I got called back and said, this is all really important. How do you feel about writing a grant and trying to do a little protocol and how to do
yes.
that? And so I changed my research focus.
Yeah.
And got funding and started doing this. And none of this would have happened if I hadn't had my chief of medicine, the chief of staff at the VA, and the dean of medicine all behind me saying, this is really important.
Yeah.
And every year they get to give you assignments for what you're supposed to do that year.
Right.
And so every year my assignment was related to advancing the research program that I'm doing.
Yes. I mean, a lot of universities and hospitals are you know, trying to get money, a lot of corporate money now. The governments have cut back and things like that. And that sometimes puts a chill on this kind of research. Even if people know that it's good, it's like they're anxious to keep their donors.
I mean, you have to get money. So people want me to do this, but I just had to go find $100,000 to start up what we were doing.
Right.
And to my surprise, actually, that was not too hard. I was able to do that pretty easily.
Did you get the money from the
NIH? I got it from, one was the manufacturer for the device, the electrical therapy device that mm-hmm. was part of the protocol. And then a charity, a small foundation out of Canada, Direct MS Charity.
Okay.
They funded us, and then when we went back and said, you know, we're getting these amazing results, we'd really like to do MRIs. They gave us more money so we could get some MRIs done. And then gave us they've been giving us a little bit of money every year as we come up with new ideas and proposals.
Right.
So I'm very grateful for these small foundations.
Right.
And I'm very grateful for my chiefs that understood how important this was and kept giving it to me as my assignment for the year.
Right. Well, I mean, I guess it's like you were saying that family is so important to the individuals on the diet. If your institution had not been supportive, it would have been
it would not have been able to happen.
Yeah, and you would have been an example, and you would have not been able to touch so many people's lives. Now, why do the big MS charities not give you money?
Well, you know, I think this is true for all research right now, because money is so tight. They only want to fund what looks like a sure bet, which means you need to have preliminary data to say a little sample of the experiment that you want to do to show that, yes, I can do it, and here's the effect size, and I can tell how many I'm going to have to study to know it's statistically significant. And the NIH is doing that. The MS Society is doing that. But that means, to be the really innovative stuff, smaller foundations are going to have to fund because it's pretty hard to. There's no slack in the budget to do things that don't have money behind them somehow. And you know what I've done. That's probably unusual for a research scientist. Is that I'm also a bit of an entrepreneur.
Mm-hmm.
So the money that I raised from my self-published book,
right.
I put into funding some of our research and hiring staff so I could do my work.
Oh, okay.
And then, in addition, the University of Iowa believes in me, and so they put in a donate here button that we could use
okay.
on our web page
right.
to allow the public to donate to the Walls Research Fund.
Yes.
And so we've been successful that way as well.
Yes. I'm sure the families of a lot of the people that you've helped are as grateful as the people that you've helped as well.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, this has become, sounds like it's become the purpose in your life, is to help other people with similar conditions or nutritional deficits.
Had I not discovered this, I would be demented and bedridden by now.
Yes.
I'd have a horrible life. I'd probably have intractable pain.
Yes, so it sounds like you would not be here right now, probably.
Well, certainly not functioning like this.
Yes.
You know, I do have research scientists challenging me, saying that what I'm doing is immoral, to put out this false hope prior to double-blind randomized studies. And I'm like, well, at the best case scenario, that's another 5 to 7 years, and we'll have thousands and thousands of years of suffering
right.
that could have been alleviated. So I think the more ethical thing to do is put the information out there
yes.
with fully disclosed that this is the area of research. And we have some interesting preliminary data. We don't have the randomized controlled studies yet. And let the public decide if this feels like a low enough risk that they want to improve the quality of their diet, add meditation and exercise.
Well,
they should have a chance to do that.
It's a strange reaction because when you change your diet in this way, there's nothing crazy, new agey about the diet. It's all recognized foods, and it's all eating. I mean, it sounds like most of it is, like most people would say, yes, you should eat more vegetables and you should eat less carbs and all of those things. So how could this hurt people? Like, how could people harmed?
I laugh. I tell people, yes, by all means, talk to your primary care doctor. Be sure that's okay to eat all these vegetables.
Yes.
And make sure you don't have any vegetable food or food medication interactions or diagnosis food interactions. But I also tell them, look, if your primary care doc is not excited about you trying to eat 6 to 9 cups of vegetables a day, get a different primary care doc.
Yes, well,
because apparently they don't know anything about disease and health and nutrition.
Yes, I think that's probably true. That was one of the questions. We're just about out of time, but maybe you could answer that question. Is the average MD educated about nutrition?
Well, they certainly aren't as educated as they should be.
Yeah.
I think primary care is probably the most open to realizing eating more vegetables, moving more, and meditation would reduce symptoms of whatever chronic disease you have.
Right.
So I tell people to work with their primary care doc and to not expect that their specialist will have any insights about nutrition.
Right.
So sad.
Yes, it is very sad. Anyway, I hope that anybody who's affected by a degenerative chronic disease will take a look at your work and consider buying the book. And I'd just like to thank you very much for coming on the show today.
Oh, thank you. It's always an absolute pleasure.
Yes, and I'll send you the link to the show after it's published, which will be in about a week from when we're taping this.
Great.
So you can share it.
And we will promote it as well.
Okay, thank you very much, Terry, and goodbye.
Thank you. Bye-bye now.